Welcome to Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice, a brand new broadcast series which has been commissioned by the Black Cultural Archives to examine the aftermath of the Windrush scandal. I am your host, Sinai Flary, and this series is dedicated to all Windrush survivors and the late Windrush campaigner, Paulette Wilson. In this final episode, Patrick Vernon OBE, Windrush campaigner and social commentator, gives us an overview of the momentous events such as the killing of George Floyd in the US, which sparked the Black Lives Matter movement across the world, and the ongoing impact of Paulette Wilson's campaigning on behalf of the Windrush generation and so much more. I began by asking Patrick to summarize the events of summer 2020 and their lasting impact.
Windrush, what's next? The struggle for justice in memory of Paulette Wilson.
The last few months have been really full on personally on different levels. Obviously, the impact of COVID-19 has a massive disproportionate impact, as you know, particularly on the Black community and the Windrush generation. With the resurgence of Black Lives Matter because of the murder of George Floyd, that has now sparked a national conversation in Britain about historical injustices, discrimination, and what more can mainstream organisations and white people can do to work as allies with the Black community. And on top of that, I've looked at the recent launch of my co-authored book, 100 Great Black Britons, which celebrates essentially over 600 years of Black British achievement and heritage.
Now, you've mentioned there your book, which I'm going to come to a bit later on. But let's talk about Black Lives Matter, because it was absolutely huge over the summer, right across the country. How impactful do you think the Black Lives Matter movement was, creating a narrative of discussing racial inequalities and disparities in Britain? And how effective do you think it will be in terms of bringing change in Britain?
I think we need to put this in a historical context. What happened this summer, because what happened in America, let's face it, the murder of George Floyd, 8 minutes, 43 seconds, where millions, if not billions of people saw what happened again and again and again on TV, online, on social media platforms. Because of COVID-19, time has stood still. So that forced the world to recognise the injustice faced by African Americans. And that also forced the world, and in particular in Britain, around our similar cases of injustices as well. So in many ways, ironically, COVID-19 has brought to the fore these conversations, which have happened over decades. I mean, as you know, Steve McQueen has produced his fantastic films under the banner of Small Acts, covering different aspects of Black British life from the late 60s up to the early 90s. And those five documentaries, which covers the Mangrove Nine, which was an historic case, which talked about basically the police lying and fabricating evidence to try and convict nine Black men and women who were fighting for their rights, to a whole range of issues of injustice. So the conversations we're having are no different to the conversations that happened in the 90s, in the 80s, in the 70s and the 60s. You have to even go far back to the 1930s with Harold Moody, who established the Legal Colored Nation People, which is talking about the colour bar in the interwar years. It can even go further back to the times of Equiano. So this is it's an important time. It's an opportunity to try and reset the agenda around race and racial discrimination and inequalities, particularly affecting Black people. Time will tell, Sina, to be quite honest, whether this will be transformational. If you remember with the murder of Stephen Lawrence, then we had the campaign done by the Lawrence family, and then the changes in law around the Race Relations Amendment Act of 2000. People thought, and that was the first time ever the government recognised institutional racism, but within 3 years after that, there was a backlash. So let's see what happens. I think the only thing that we can do is keep on agitating and keep on engaging. And for those organisations who are serious about race equality and anti-racism, let's work with them.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's, been a lot of conversations this year which are great, but I'm keen to see what happens next. Going back to the Windrush
scandal. Now, you've campaigned tirelessly for, you know, raising awareness for, you know, a National Windrush Day and so many other causes. How would you describe the legacy of the Windrush generation?
The legacy is just ginormous. I mean, we still need to still document this legacy properly. Obviously, the work of Black Quarter Archives for the last 30-odd years has been doing that, to be quite honest. They've documented through people donating to the archives a number of Windrush Generation people in terms of their lives, work around politics, education, policing, the arts, culture and media. So people have donated their archives as prosperity, so we can see the legacy of individual men and women who have made a difference, you know, and also other cultural institutions and bodies have done that. With, you know, we've had a whole range of publications, fictional and non-fictional books and films, etc. But, you know, what I think is needed personally is the oral histories. We need to have a national depository of all the oral histories of the Windrush generation for prosperity's sake. That's what happened in America. There was a program in the 1930s called the Federal Bureau Project, where during the Great Depression, they had the foresight to employ unemployed writers to go into the deep south of America and to interview people who had not the second-hand and third-hand experiences of enslavement in the deep south. They record those oral narratives, and then in the Library of Congress. And those oral narratives is a rich resource and material that's been used for the curriculum system in America, for films, publications, etc. We need to do something similar. I know that the British Library and other institutions have got their own archives, oral archives, as well as local museums. But if we had a national depository, and more importantly, we need to have a drive to record as many Windrush generation voices who are still alive. That is a lesson that we should learn from the Windrush scandal, that we need to document these histories. If we could record, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of all these oral histories, that would be a powerful testament in terms of people, what people did, the jobs that they did, how they came to Britain, their contribution at a local, national level as well. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, I agree. And speaking about the Windrush generation, this show is dedicated to the late Windrush campaigner, Paulette Wilson, who I know you met during your work on the Windrush scandal. Tell us a little bit about Paulette and what she was like.
Yeah, Paulette, I got to know her during the time of the scandal. Ironically, we're both from Wolverhampton. I didn't know her at the time when I was growing up in Wolverhampton. It's only when she got caught up in a scandal, and I remember reading the interview she had with Amelia Gentleman in The Guardian. It must have been around about August, September 2017. And then soon afterwards, I got formally involved in exposing the scandal when I launched my petition a few months later. And when, as a result of doing the petition and raising that and engaging with the media, I remember sharing a number of media platforms with Paulette and with her daughter Natalie, and then we exchanged details and we became friends, and we used to be in regular contact with each other. And when I used to go up to Wolverhampton to visit my parents, I would meet up with Paulette and with Natalie. We'd go to the Heritage Centre in Wolverhampton, which is a Black run community centre, which ironically used to be the headquarters of the Conservative Party in Wolverhampton. And it's alleged where Enoch Powell drafted his speech, Rivers of Blood, in that building. So it's ironic now, you know, that it's owned by the community, that same building. So I used to meet Paulette there in the bar, we used to have a drink, just catch up and stuff like that. And then we always kept in contact. So she was a fantastic person. She was small in stature, as you see from the interviews. But she was graceful, she was very humble. And part of that humbleness was because of her faith of Rastafarianism. That was really important to her in terms of Rastafari. And so she saw the world from a holistic community perspective, which I think is important. And she, even though she was angry and bitter how she was treated, because remember, she had two spells of detention in the Yarnswood Centre, where basically you were kept against your will. That been convicted of anything at all, on suspicion that you're a legal immigrant. And, you know, sadly and ultimately, I think that broke her spirit. Having those spells of detention, taking away your civil liberties, it's like, for many, it's almost like a reenactment of enslavement again for those who identify with that. And but despite all of that, she was funny, she was gregarious, and also her daughter, Natalie, who I, she's adopted me, she's called me uncle now, and we're really good friends, and both of them together were like a powerhouse. I use the expression, the Jamaican expression, little but talawa. That was Paulette. She was small in stature, but in terms of when she spoke and how she spoke and how she shared her lived experiences of being affected by the Windrush scandal and the hostile environment policy, took the lives of millions of people in Britain. And I mean that, millions of people in Britain. So when she sadly passed away, and as you know, we were planning and designing these shows, working with the BCA, and that's why we decided to name these podcasts and these radio shows, also the conference that BCA organised in September in memory of Paulette. And I worked with Natalie. We launched and her cousin. We launched a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for the funeral costs. And you know, people donated within a matter of a week. We raised the money for her funeral. That was the love that people had for her around the country. I mean, she's had so many tributes in the media and internationally as well, and that's why more and more people are now naming awards after her. Recently, we had the Windrush Caribbean Film Festival, which recognised Amelia Gentleman and Nadine White.
Patrick, glad you mentioned Amelia Gentleman and Nadine White. I spoke to both award-winning journalists on separate occasions about Paulette Wilson and the Windrush scandal. I started by asking Amelia when it was she first began writing about what would later be known as the Windrush scandal.
When I first began to write about it in November of 2017, I didn't know at all what the issue was that I was writing about. I met a woman called Paulette Wilson first because the charity that had been helping her was really, really worried about her case. They emailed me when she was being held in Yarlswood Detention Centre, and she was listed to be transferred imminently for a deportation flight back to Jamaica. And this was a really surprising decision for the Home Office to have taken, because Paulette was then 61. She had arrived from Jamaica in around 1968 to live with her grandparents when she was 10. She'd been at primary school in the UK, secondary school, worked here for decades, paid taxes, brought up her daughter and granddaughter, and hadn't committed any offence that would have really explained why she'd been twice arrested and sent to immigration detention centre. So I went to meet Paulette. She'd been released from detention by that point, but was still facing deportation. We published a story about her case in The Guardian, and the response was immediate, both from readers who were outraged, but also from other people who, it turned out, were experiencing similar difficulties with the Home Office. And in the days that followed, I got a number of calls and emails from people who'd been living in the UK for around half a century, who'd been really horrified to find that they'd been classified as illegal immigrants when they thought that they were British.
I also paid tribute to Nadine White for her reporting of the Windrush scandal and asked how such coverage made her feel and how she was able to emotionally detach from the scandal and the suffering of survivors, given that she knew some of them personally.
Angry. Angry is my immediate response. Hurt. I always say, I mean, I work for HuffPost UK. I've been with them for a couple of years now, and I focus on current affairs, but my my specialism within that is race and social justice. And so I cover a lot of stories that has to do with racism, discrimination and injustice quite regularly, particularly as it relates to Black people. And I always say it's very hard to emotionally detach myself from these stories. because first and foremost, before I'm a journalist, I'm a black woman. But with covering the Windrush scandal and the atrocities inflicted upon descendants of the Windrush generation, I saw my grandparents who migrated, I saw my father, I saw aunts, saw the community in which I was raised in the South London, reflected in these stories. And I happen to know several people personally who were affected by the Windrush scandal. So it made me very angry. I spoke, at the top of this conversation about the contributions that the Windrush generation has made to UK society and how that has been overlooked for the most part. And it just made me think, for them to uproot from their country of birth where they've been living, migrate to a land to the mother country's call for assistance in its hour of need, following World War II, to give so much to this country over the years, to endure racism and bigotry and all manner of unpleasant experiences when they did initially settle in the UK, to then down the line and have their descendants be treated like this, it was difficult to cover. But, it's important work. It's important to amplify these experiences and hold the government to account for the way in which they've treated the Windrush generation. Be angry and hurt comes to mind.
Do you think enough is being done to put things right?
Absolutely not. Enough isn't being done, and it's frankly appalling. So recently, the Home Secretary Priti Patel reiterated that quote-unquote institutional ignorance and thoughtlessness towards the issue of race and the history of the Windrush generation led to the Windrush scandal, which is the worst political scandal in modern history, and they pledged to right the wrongs, as you say. And so the Home Office, organised the Windrush Lessons Learned Review recommendations, the 30 recommendations, into 5 themes to ensure lasting institutional change. But, even the government's official response, and this was published back in September, towards the end of September, it just had glaring omissions and a lot of gaps in its response, which sent a clear message that the Home Office, the government, by extension, is not serious about righting the wrongs, or has not done due diligence then in righting the wrongs. There was no recognition, for instance, in the Lessons Learned Review that the hostile environment is in fact alive and kicking and still wreaking a detrimental impact on victims of the Windrush scandal to this day. There's issues around compensation, and there was no explanation in the Home Office's plan of how it will solve the problems around compensation. And I just think it's a sad indictment on the government that 2 years down the line after the scandal first came to light, that many victims have not received compensation. As I understand it, £2 million has been offered to people out of a total pot of £250 million to be paid through the scheme. That's a very low amount indeed. And again, in this plan from the Home Office, there was no plan or no outline on how the government plans to repair broken trust. At the end of the day, this fundamental lack of trust between black communities and the government is going to create obstacles for the Home Office in undertaking the recommendation to be more proactive, they say, in identifying those affected. There's a lot of gaping holes. They mentioned that, they plan to implement a staff learning program on UK history with an aim of teaching staff about the history of the UK and its relationship with the world, including Britain's colonial history. So there's a lot of big chat. There's a lot of pretty promises, for want of a better phrase. But there's, it seems quite hollow.
And also, the Baton Awards are now dedicated one of their categories to her.
Well, Patrick, I also caught up with Diane Riney, the founder of the Baton Awards, and asked her why she renamed one of her awards after the late Paulette Wilson.
The Windrush, I call it just absolute scandal. It's such a big thing for my generation and my parents' generation. And I think people who do campaign or become activists, sometimes they think, I don't know, when I speak to people, they think you need to have this special, diploma or something. Sometimes it's just about what I call showing up. being the change you want to see and keep pushing those boundaries. And I thought, what Paulette done, and when I've spoken to her daughter, Natalie, what they've done is just amazing, to put this big spotlight on something where the spotlight needed to be shone. And when I found out about her passing, I was just stopped in my tracks. And I just thought, do you know what? We need to honour this lady. And what we're going to do, and what I've decided and the team have decided to do, is from 2021, it will be called the Paulette Wilson Campaigner of the Year Award. Because I think when you have those kinds of great examples, people who will stand the, you know, the test of time and always will be remembered, I think that is just such a beacon for any up-and-coming campaigner, to let them know that you can, and you can be that. You might think you're a small cog, but you can create great change.
Also, in Wolverhampton, I'm working with a number of local councillors, particularly Councillor Sandra Samuels, one of the few black councillors in Wolverhampton, and other councillors, to try and get a blue plaque for Paulette. And also a close friend of the family, who's a student at Wolverhampton University, who is in the art department, has convinced the dean of the department that a number of students are going to do a number of artistic and creative sculptures and other things to acknowledge Paulette's contribution. She was a fantastic person. It's just really sad that at the young age of 64, that she's now gone.
Absolutely, and she's left behind her daughter, Natalia, and also a very powerful legacy. You know, Patrick, you've done so much work. You know, I call you our community champion, because that's the only way I can describe you. What do you think? I think you are more than qualified than anybody to speak on this when I ask this question. What needs to be done next where the Windrush scandal is concerned?
It's the kind of things I've been saying for the last couple of years. It's what was my original petition I did back in March 2018. And there were three things I said in the petition which still hold true today. Firstly, compensation which is fair and just to meet the emotional and financial needs of the Windrush victims and survivors and their families. Yes, there is a compensation scheme. It's over £2.5 million have been awarded so far. It needs to go faster and quicker enough. That the Home Secretary has acknowledged that herself, that more needs to be done to make it easier. So that is really critical. People need to be paid. People have suffered far too long and are experiencing the financial impact, which has further been reinforced with COVID-19. So people need to be paid like now and as soon as possible, and to be paid generously in what they are targeted for. Secondly, there are people whose status has still not been recognised properly. People have been rejected by the Home Office Windrush Task Force because they may have a criminal past record, which they may have had as a teenager, that's been held against them. That needs to be resolved. And I did mention that there seemed to be a difference of how the Windrush generation is treated compared to people or who are in Hong Kong, and I know that the Home Office don't see the difference, but I think there's a difference between the treatment of the Windrush generation and people who've now been given almost like automatic status. I think that needs to be done. Why couldn't we have done the automatic scheme and say, you're British, you don't need to go for the rigmarole of having more additional information. That adds additional stress and pressure as well, and forcing people to go underground. And thirdly, the government had suspended deportation flights for almost 18 months. Then they resumed one flight prior to the lockdown, and there are plans for another flight in the next couple of weeks. Those flights need to, in the light of Wendy Williams's report, which I think was quite important, an important report, an important intervention, it's important that the government should. I know that they're going to review the hostile environment policy till 2022, but it's too long. That needs to be reviewed like now. because this is having an impact on all these deportation flights which are taking place, and particularly the impacts of deportation flights, and you know, with Bella Sankey and the work that she's doing, potential action, working with families, it has an impact on family life. People are losing their fathers, their uncles, their brothers, to this. So that needs to be looked. So we've still got more work to do. I am hoping, I'm until optimist, as you know, Sanai, that with ongoing campaigning and more politicians across all the political parties can seriously say to themselves, if we are going to right the wrongs, and that is a very high bar, by the way, righting the wrongs, that if we're going to right the wrongs, then a lot of things still need to be resolved if the government talks about that in that way.
Patrick, what does it mean to be black in the UK right now?
Well, I think if you look at Lewis Hamilton, it's good. I mean, on one level, I mean, if you look at Lewis Hamilton and what he's achieved against all odds, and he was recently voted the most influential black person and the powerless, which was launched by Michael about 15 years ago, former editor of New Nation. And what the powerless has done is to celebrate black influence and black achievement. I have to acknowledge Jackie McKenzie, good friend Jackie, who was in the top 10 of the powerless. And also she was given a separate award for her work, legal work, way before the scandal broke, to be quite honest, for her consistent legal work and advice to the Winners Generation around legal advice, representation, around immigration, appeals advice as well. So I think it's fantastic. I'm really pleased that she got the award. I was luckily acknowledged as part of that panelist myself, so it's great to be acknowledged as well. So I think that's important. But on one level, there are lots of black achievers who are now using their privilege in the right way for the community. But at the same time, we also know that there is a massive disconnect with the rest of the community, how they are treated and experiencing everyday racism. You just have to look at all the data around educational stuff, what's happening in schools. We've still got massive school exclusions still taking place. No different, haven't shifted, that dial has not shifted in the last 20 years. Of representation in the psychiatric mental health forensic system of particularly of black men and women, that hasn't shifted also. COVID-19 has further put more people to lose their jobs, which also has an impact on the black community, particularly black women, who often are raising families and working at the same time. I could go on and on and on. I mean, it's, you know, I wrote a blog recently saying that we are tired, we're fatigued, and we are traumatized because we have to deal with the impact of racism. Black Lives Matter has now shined a light on that, and now white people are now starting to appreciate. We didn't realize that it was that bad. We didn't realize that it wasn't. We thought it was just a figment of your imagination when you talked about race and discrimination. But now we believe that. So let's see what happens with that. But I think it's about agency. All of us in the community need to do our bit. It's not enough for what you're doing, what Colourful Radio is doing, what I'm doing, what other people are doing. All of us need to do our bit for the community. We can't just sit back and expect people to do the legwork. We all have to work together and synergize, co-produce, that's what we did back in the day. When the Winners Generation first came to Britain, they had no choice but to work together. There were more community buildings and more community assets maybe in the 60s, 70s compared to now. Okay, we might have our own individual assets, like our houses, our cars, and holiday homes, and some people have done quite well in doing property development, having several properties. But we haven't got many community assets that we can lever to make a difference for the next generation. That is a challenge. I mean, I work closely with Yvonne Field, the founder of UBLA, a fantastic person, and they are developing a program and initiative around community wealth partnerships. So it's not about individual wealth, it's about community wealth. Social enterprises, community organisations, building the infrastructure so we can create jobs, employment, housing schemes. That's what we need to do.
You speak so passionately there about the community doing their bit, and you're somebody I admire and that I'm inspired by, because you're always doing your bit. And this year you did your bit by co-authoring such an important book called The 100 Great Black Britons. Can you tell us more about that book?
Yeah, sure, yeah. The book is based on a campaign that I conceived 17 years ago, which my co-author, Dr. Angelina Osborne, was involved in. We worked together to launch, develop the campaign. Mary Seacole was voted in 2004 as greatest Black Britain of all time, which had a massive reverberation. Firstly, you know, a number of nurses, especially Elizabeth Onwell, who is now retired from the NHS, well-respected nurse and clinician and academic, working with the likes of Lord Soley and other and the Royal College of Nursing to raise the money for the Mary Seacole statue, which was unveiled 4 years ago. Mary Seacole was included for the first time in the national curriculum, along with Equiano. And then finally, the Royal College of Nursing adopted Mary Seacole on the same status of footing as Florence Nightingale. That was that was some of the impacts of that campaign. So the book itself, 17 years on, me and Angelina, we were commissioned to write the book, but we were actually in the middle of launching a campaign anyway, because a new campaign 17 years later, because we did this before Black Lives Matter, but we recognised that there was a shift in what the community was saying and doing. More people were using their privilege in the community, and also there's a new range of heroes and sheroes making a difference in the community as well that has to be recognised. So the book came out in September. We have featured 100 people. We had a public nomination process. We actually had over 1,000 nominations, and we had a judging panel, and we selected 100, which are in the book as part of the campaign. But in the book also, we have listed the 1,000 people that the public have nominated also, because they are achievers and they're doing great stuff for the community too.
Patrick, before you go, where would you like to see the Black British community in the next 5 years?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I think we just need to seize this moment. Black Lives Matter is now a window of opportunity again. This happens every 20, if you look at history of Black civil rights in Britain, every 10, 20 years, there was a kind of the door opens and then the door shuts again. So the door is currently open. I'm hoping that door will still be open in 5 years' time, where we have honest conversations around racism, discrimination, anti-racism, Afrophobia, that there are that mainstream organisations and institutions seriously take and value and respect Black talent in terms of jobs, employment and business opportunities, and that we have more great representation, particularly in politics, in NHS and other key institutions that we as taxpayers pay and expect high standards of probity, high standards. People talk about Nolan principles, which is about people in public life. And we need to have more people in public life from the Black community to further open the doors for more opportunities and to use our lived experience to shape and influence policy strategy across the public, private and voluntary sector.
Patrick Vernon, it's always an absolute joy to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining me on Windrush, What's Next? The Struggle for Justice.
It's a pleasure, and all the viewers, please support the work of Kofa Radio. Please support Black media outlets who are doing the stuff in the community, all the community radio stations. And also want to big up you, Sinai, for your fantastic work as a journalist and a broadcaster and a publisher too.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
That brings this special audio series to a close. I hope you have found it enjoyable, educational, and perhaps you are now even more curious than you were before about the Windrush generation and their positive contribution to society, their fight for justice, and their lasting impact on our lives. My name is Sinai Flary, and I have been your host on this very important series, with special thanks to Patrick Vernon OBE and the Black Cultural Archives. Produced by Colourful during lockdown, funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation, it has been an honour to present this series, which is dedicated to all Windrush scandal survivors, the Windrush generation, and the late Windrush campaigner, Paulette Wilson.
The Windrush What's Next series is supported by funds from the Paul Hamlin Foundation.